Welcome to the Economics Explored podcast, a frank and fearless exploration of important economic issues. I'm your host, Gene Tunney. I'm a professional economist and former Australian Treasury official. The aim of this show is to help you better understand the big economic issues affecting all our lives. We do this by considering the theory, evidence, and by hearing a wide range of views. I'm delighted that you can join me for this episode. Please check out the show notes for relevant information. Now on to the show. Hello and welcome to the show. In this episode, we're tackling what many see as a profound demographic and economic challenge, the decline in fertility rates that we've seen throughout the world. The latest data from the ABS show that Australia's fertility rates fall into just 1.48 births per woman. That's the lowest in recorded history, and it's well below the replacement rate of 2.1. This trend is going to reshape our nation's economy and our society in the decades ahead. A smaller, younger generation means that we have fewer taxpayers to support an aging population, there's more pressure on government budgets, and there will be slower economic growth. It will mean that we become even more reliant on migration to keep our population growing. This isn't unique to Australia. Fertility rates have plunged or are plunging across most of the world. According to Pew Research, Africa is now the only region with fertility rates above 2.1, though even there, birth rates have been falling steadily. The UN forecasts that global fertility, it'll drop below replacement by around 2050, leading to population peaks near 10.3 billion in 2084 before it starts falling. By 2100, 97% of countries are expected to have fertility rates under 2.1, with only a few in sub-Saharan Africa and parts of the Pacific remaining above replacement. To unpack what's driving this shift and what it means for our economic future, I'm joined by my friend and my co-host on the Australian Taxpayers Alliance live stream, economist John Humphreys. John and I discuss why people are having fewer children, the limits of migration as a population strategy, and whether our welfare systems and the profound social changes that we've seen since the 1960s, whether they've discouraged family formation. We discuss whether Australia needs to consider reintroducing the baby bonus, which was available from 2004 to 2014. It was a financial incentive of up to $5,000 per birth and arguably was successful in lifting Australia's fertility rate in the 2000s. Overall, Australia's fertility rate increased from around 1.78 in 2004 when the baby bonus was introduced to a peak of just over 2 in 2008. A large part of this was a timing effect, with women bringing forward births, but recent E61 research shows that some of it was a permanent increase, mostly among younger and lower income households where the financial incentive was relatively more significant. It doesn't appear to have incentivized higher income households. So by permanent increase, I mean that these are births that would not have happened otherwise. So they are genuinely additional births, additional people in the population. We've also seen that the pro-natalist policies, they've had some success in Hungary. However, they have come at a high cost, and despite significantly increasing its fertility rate, it's still below the replacement rate. The economic and social forces driving down fertility are so strong that it's hard to push against them with policy. And I think you'll get a sense of that from my conversation with John. The conversation featured in this episode, it's an edited version of my latest Australian Taxpayers Alliance live stream with John Humphreys from 16 October 2025. The themes, they're so significant and so relevant to long-term economic policy that I wanted to share them here on Economics Explored. Indeed, the conversation I had with John was inspired by a suggestion that I had from regular Economics Explored listener, Taylor. Taylor, thanks for getting in touch and suggesting this topic. Some of the issues John and I discuss are sensitive, they're controversial, and I expect you'll have your own views on them, which may differ from my views and John's. I'm interested in your thoughts on them, on these issues, so please let me know your thoughts. You can email me at contact@economicsexplored.com. I'd love to hear from you. Let me know, especially if you want me to do a deeper dive into the evidence on the baby bonus and pro-natalist policies across the world, particularly in Hungary. Now, let's jump into our conversation on the falling fertility rate and what it could mean for Australia's economy and society in the years ahead. I hope you enjoy it.
Anyway, that's the Australia's data. I believe, though, you had something else for us.
Something else on Australia, but I think it's consistent with something we've previously talked about when we had our discussion at the Friedman Conference on the birth gap. I don't know if you remember that, John, a couple of years ago. The latest births data from the ABS came out yesterday and show that our total fertility rate, so this is the number of babies born per woman, so they work out an estimate of that. That's now, it stayed below 1.5 and it's declining, so it's it was just, you know, a real like cigarette paper difference between the figure and 1.5 in 2023, but now in 2024, we're opening up more of a gap. So it's about, I should have remembered the exact rate. It's 1.48 something or something of that, close to that. Let me just bring it up.
That's right. 1.48. Yeah.
That's it. Yes. So well below replacement rate. Replacement rate's 2.1. So you need one for mum, one for dad, and then you need one for accident. One for the country. So because Costello said mum, one for dad, one for the country. That came from Winston Churchill when he was the Home Secretary in the early part of the 20th century, and I think he wanted them to have one for mum, one for dad, one for accident and one for the country, because, you know, infant mortality was much higher back then. But essentially you need on average more than two to compensate for mortality, people not living to adulthood. This is hugely concerning. There was a period from after the introduction of the baby boom. Now, whether that's causation or correlation can be debated, but it was tracking back up toward two from the mid-2000s, and there was a lot of excitement about that. Is it because of the, what was it, $5,000 baby bonus that was introduced by the Howard government? But since, that really, after that was withdrawn, or it's been changed, hasn't it? There's the different subsidies that have been put in place. I'm trying to remember exactly what the policy settings are, but essentially we don't have the old baby bonus.
I think it's parental leave now.
That's for, yes. And so the fertility rate's been trending back down over the last decade or so. And look, there could be a whole range of reasons for that. I mean, there's preferences, there's people remaining single longer or never partnering. There's just the cost of living. There's the concerns about the cost of living. I mean, we know what's happening with housing costs. People are going to be delaying having children, and maybe they're having fewer children. So that's what we're seeing. And, you know, it's starting to get to, I think, concerning levels, because it's getting to a level where it's well below where it was in the early 2000s when we started being concerned about the aging of the population, and we started becoming concerned about these demographic issues. And that's when the Howard government introduced the baby bonus. Now we're well below that, and I don't know whether we'll continue, but I mean, worst case, you end up somewhere like Italy or Japan with their fertility rates of, I don't know, 1.2, 1.3, or maybe even lower. So it's, and then what do? You basically have to rely upon migration to grow your population. I mean, we are doing that at the moment, largely. We've still got some natural increase because the baby boom cohort was so large that the cohorts after that have been relatively large too, and there's still more births and because of all the migrants were brought in, all the, as well, there's still more births than deaths, but that will eventually turn around and we'll be solely relying upon migration. And that raises, I mean, there's, I think we're already seeing issues about whether we can cope with the level of migration that we've got at the moment. And that's going to become, we're going to become even more dependent on it for a growing population and to help pay for public services. So yes, you know, huge concern there. And John, I think, I mean, you share my concern with the low fertility rate too, if I recall correctly.
Well, if you remember that great event we did at the Friedman Conference a couple of years ago,
yeah.
I was the Chicken Little, I believe, of that session. And I said then something that I've repeated a few times since, that I think this is the issue of this century. Like if you look back in history, if you know your history, the 5th century, what happened? Rome collapsed. The 11th century, what happened? You know, the Normans conquered England. There's some big thing that happens in a century. People don't remember the details of what happened in all of the years before and after Rome collapsed. Rome collapsed. That is the thing that happened that century. And when people look back on the 21st century, they're not going to remember terrorism. They're not going to remember climate change. They're not going to remember COVID. They're going to remember, oh, that was the century where the human species started dying out for no apparent reason. That's like the first, one of the only times in history where you had massive worldwide population shrinkage because of wealth. Like not because of war, not because of poverty. We've seen that before, right? If people get poor enough, their populations decline. If people go to enough wars, their populations decline. We are living through a period of unprecedented prosperity and some of the lowest levels of war in the history of humankind. And we are suddenly seeing not just a tip down of fertility rates. It's not just ducking below 2. It is plummeting. Australia is 1.5 or 1.48 now. You expressed surprise that it kept going down. I was saying this 3 years ago. It's going down everywhere and it's not stopping.
Yeah.
And everyone thinks, oh, it'll stop at 1.0 now. Yeah. And it goes to 1.8. Oh, it'll stop at 1.8. It's below 1 in Hong Kong, in Korea, in the eastern coasts of China. I believe now Japan's just tipping below 1. This is a massive issue that's going on. And it's going on worldwide. So this migration issue is not even a real solution. Firstly, I agree with you. It's not a smart solution internally, right? We've got other problems here. You can't just keep mixing massive numbers of people from different places and just assuming that everybody is just an equal cog in a machine that you can just change out as your carburetor breaks. So there's other problems with migration. But putting that aside, migrants from where? East Asia, population collapsing. Like, by the way, I should point this out. The population isn't collapsing yet. It takes about 30 to 40 years from when population goes down for it to start showing up in the population data, which is why this is such an insidious problem, because we can see the train wreck coming from 40 years away, but no one is really experiencing it until it's way too late to change direction. But put that aside. So the fertility has collapsed in East Asia. So we're not getting people from East Asia. It's just fallen below 2 in the subcontinent. A lot of people worried about Indian migration. China's population is already going backwards. India's population is going to start turning the corner soon. So you're going to start running out of, start shrinking the population in the subcontinent. The Middle East and North Africa, it's just getting down to below 2. Europe, well below 2. North America, well below 2. And then the North Americans say, well, we can just get people from South America. South American fertility is lower than North American fertility. They're getting down close to 1. This is a worldwide phenomenon. This is going on pretty much everywhere except sub-Saharan Africa. And even sub-Saharan Africa is seeing their fertility rate go down, but there is from like very high levels to now just high levels. So they're still above 2. This is happening everywhere. It seems unstoppable. Hungary threw, I think, 7% of GDP at the problem, and they got their fertility rate from 1.2 up to 1.3. I mean, this...
Oh, right.
This is a massive issue with huge consequences, yeah. And no one really even knows what's causing it, and no one can seem to work out any solution. And then everyone says something like that, a common answer from Aussie here, and not meaning to rip on you, Aussie, because it's a very obvious thing to think of there. But cost of living implies we don't have enough money to have kids. This is happening most to people with the most money. Richer countries, as you get richer, your fertility rate drops. Inside those countries, the richer people, their fertility rate drops. So, I mean, the fertility rate is still very high in Zambia. And it's not because Zambia has a higher quality of living or a lower cost of living than Australia. Mm. It's not because Zambia is so much richer than us they can have that many more kids. I think the second part of what Aussie wrote there, I think that's a part of it, cost of housing. But not just because, you know, we can't afford housing, but because the cost of housing is getting people to live in smaller houses. When people live in smaller houses, they tend to have smaller families. So I think that is part of the story. But really, everything you can think of to explain this, you can find counterexamples. It is an insidious problem that is really hard to unpack. And I don't think people have the faintest clue what this is going to mean yet, because this is going to be, you know, the aging of the population on steroids. But then when populations start to shrink, I know I'm going on quite a long rant here, but I don't think people have thought this through. When populations start to shrink, you're going to see the natural state of affairs is that asset prices will decline. So what do you invest in? Right, because I'll take this back a step, right? So the population is, fertility rate going down. That means the population ages, people get older, and that happens, you know, pretty quickly. That's the first order effect. Second order effect is after about 30, 40 years, when the bigger generations start dying off and the next generation is smaller and smaller, you start seeing population shrinkage.
Yeah.
And so, when the first one happens with the aging population, we just don't have enough young people to pay tax into the system that people need for their pensions and for their healthcare, and especially healthcare, right? Because old people take up most of the healthcare. And so that's a problem that's already big enough and probably insolvable for most welfare states, right? This is just a fundamentally unsustainable situation we're in welfare states. But then you at least have a theoretical solution to that. The theoretical solution is you incentivize people to save to pay for their own life, right? I mean, you incentivize people to save up more, to invest in a long-term health fund, in their concessional savings for their retirement, as we discussed a bit earlier. Mm. So you've got a theoretical answer, but that theoretical answer comes from incentivize people to save more. And we should do that. But then go to phase two of this problem. The population starts shrinking. What do you invest in when you save? Share market is going to go down 5% a year, and that'll be normal, right? That's not, I've had a horrible year. It'll be, oh, my share price only went down 2%. Oh, well done. What did you do? You did really good investing. I mean, that's going to be the new normal when you've got a global shrinking population. I don't think people have even started thinking what the consequences of this are going to be. And then the third order effect, by the way, which is the really fun one, is different sorts of populations have different fertility rates. The real news is the world is going to end up being ruled by the Amish and the Orthodox. Look at the Amish and Orthodox Jews are the only two people who seem to have kicked the trend. That's it.
Is that right? Oh, okay. We'll have to look up those stats. Yeah, incredible.
But yes, religious people tend to have more kids. People with conservative outlooks tend to have more kids. People who invest more on intra-group social capital rather than intergroup social capital, i.e. you form a close bond with your community and invest in your community as opposed to going and helping save the spotted whale in South Bolivia or whatever, those sort of people have high fertility. So we're going to see a fundamental change in the nature of humankind as one cohort, basically the radical left, all just die off.
Incredible. I mean, one thing I'm wondering now, John, were the Amish right all along? So they've got that a very deliberative approach to new technology, whereas we embrace it. We just adopt it without thinking about whether it's going to be net beneficial to us. And I'm this is partly a jest, but the Cal Newport writes about that in one of his books. They have a very deliberative approach to technology. They think about will this benefit us? Do we need to take advantage of this? So, yes, interesting. I'll have to look at their fertility data. I find that fascinating.
I think it has more to do with the social bonds. I mean, this is one of my the theories I have that seems to show up fairly consistently. It's how well connected you are to the triumvirate that I spoke about at CPAC last year, to how close are you linked to your family, church, and community? And if you're not a Christian, some equivalent of church, I don't know, so Lions Club or mosque or synagogue or whatever it is for you. But the closer ties you have to family, church, and community, the higher your fertility rate tends to be. And I think the Amish have very closely linked to their family, church, and community.
Yeah.
By the way, another comment here from Ozzy I think is worth picking up. I think this is absolutely right, by the way. And I think this is the sort of comment that we have been told for the last couple of decades that you're not really allowed to say. But I actually think I think people rebel against the idea of immigrants because that's the only thing you're allowed to say. But I think it'd be the conversation that would be much better to have if we can is how do we pick the immigrants that actually are most likely to add value, to bring the net benefits without bringing the net costs? And maybe that means we just have to learn to be pickier and to be a bit more honest about what we want to pick.
Yeah, but the government pretends that's what it's doing, right?
So, but only on economic issues, right? So.
Right, okay. Oh, right. Oh, gee, yeah, I mean, that's...
So not allowed to say that, right? But
well, I don't know if you're not allowed to say it, but it's. I mean, we certainly don't want to let people in who don't share our values and will cause trouble in the community. But how do you screen? I mean, that's difficult to screen for, isn't it? And we have to have a non-discriminatory immigration policy with respect to country of, well, not necessarily country of origin, because they could be coming from. An area or a rogue regime. So
why do we need to have non-discriminatory? Firstly, we don't currently. We currently have a discriminatory immigration policy where if you are a Kiwi, you can come at any time for any reason, no questions asked, just get on the plane. And we don't have that policy. And I'm not suggesting we get rid of that. Yeah. I'm saying like Kiwis are probably the exact sort of people who can very easily integrate into Australia. So I'm not trying to rip on the Kiwi immigration system that we've got here.
Yeah.
But we already discriminate. Thankfully, we discriminate for exactly the sort of country that would fit in quite well. Look, it's a third rail of Australian politics to mention that. And I think because people are scared of where that conversation can trend, they find the much safer thing to say is just cut immigration. And look, sure, we've got probably had too many migrants for what's good for the country lately. But I think the fuller conversation is not just the raw numbers. It's the which sort of migrants add value to the country. And I don't just mean economic value, just add value. But which migrants would improve the quality of family, churches, and community? To go back to the previous question of the sort of things that actually drive fertility rate, probably drive fertility rate because they drive people actually being happy in their own lives. I don't have an easy answer for that, by the way, but I think at some stage that might be a conversation we have to be allowed to have, or else all we can have is this sort of binary question of do you want to turn immigration on or off, which I think is not a very nuanced way to look at immigration.
I think we've got to have the debate about the policy settings we have in place, which are allowing far too many student visas without, the necessary accommodation, and then the easy path from student visa to permanent residency. So there's there's a very high percentage of those who come in on a student visa who 10 years later get permanent residency. It's something like 40% or something like that, right? So I think we've got to be looking at those policy settings because that's what's causing all the. I mean, there's certainly the social cohesion issues. It looks like we've let some people into the country who don't share our values, who want to, carry on conflicts from other parts of the world. So that's clearly an issue. But the bigger issue, or not to say that's not a significant issue, but where people are really feeling it is just the sheer numbers of people that are pushing up rents, that are pushing up house prices, that are causing congestion. And a lot of that is to do with the policy settings regarding the student visas and just how easy then it is to get the permanent residency.
No, I agree with that, but there's the sting in the tail of that question, I'm fine with where this goes, but other people won't be. That's because our university system doesn't work without massive numbers of foreign students, right? It's a, Now, universities are massively cross-subsidized. If we want to continue having our current students receiving a massive cross-subsidy, and our students already don't like the fact that they have HEX, right? But that HEX is a delayed loan, which is a pretty convenient way to get a loan. So lucky there to start with. And secondly, the value of your HEX is already half of the retail value of your degree. For most people, it's massively cross-subsidized, right? You're not paying the full cost. Your HEX isn't the full cost of your degree. It's like half the cost of your degree. And how is it you get half? That's mostly not cross-subsidized by the Australian government. It's mostly cross-subsidized by foreign students. Right? So, I mean, go back to before when we talked about the aging of the population, pushing pensions up higher, pushing health up higher. That's been happening for a couple of decades. Like Costello was talking about that more than 20 years ago, introduced the intergenerational report. Good thing that he did. And pension, aged spending, health spending have all been growing faster than GDP. And that's why we keep having budget deficits now. The only offsetting thing they've had is that it's been bipartisan agreement to wind back on government funding of higher education, basically. That's one of the only areas they've wound back government spending. That's one of the only places they could find it politically acceptable to balance the books because, you know, health, aged, and pensions, those costs are just running unsustainably out of control. So they've wound back that university spending, but they still have all of this cohort of university students who still get to vote. Maybe they shouldn't, but they do. And so you need to cross-subsidize them somehow. Foreign students, massive foreign student cross-subsidy. And why do foreign students come to Australia? Not because we've got that great education system, but because they know it's a backdoor visa system. Right? They know it's a way to get an Australian passport. So the problem there is if they say, oh, you can still come here, but you have to leave after 3 years, a lot fewer people will want to show up. If we just say, look, we're not allowing student visas, then, you know, they're just not allowed to show up. Either way, that would mean we either have to have the government increase spending on universities by an order of magnitude. So where do we get that money from? We already can't afford our system. Or we just have to let half the universities go bust. And I say, when I said at the beginning, I'm fine with where this goes, I actually think we should let half our universities go bust. I think our universities are currently a net drain and taking our country backwards. I think far too many people go to university. Far too many people study stupid things at university. Far too much stuff that happens at university is bullshit that would be actively better off if it didn't happen. Not just it doesn't give value, it creates anti-value. So I think that's not a bad outcome, is if we just massively scale back the university sector in this country, says the former university lecturer. But I don't suspect that that is going to get 50% plus one votes in a federal election. So this is the catch 22 that Liberal and Labor have, right? They've looked at this. They know that people would love it for them to say we're winding back student visas or we're not letting students get permanent visas. But then they look at the university system and go, we can't afford it. Uni students vote. We can't let all our universities go bust. Shit, what do we do?
I think we're going to have to crunch the numbers on this, John. I think there's some good insights there. I just want to have a look at what that would mean. I mean, you said an order of magnitude. I know you're exaggerating, but there's no doubt that it would mean significantly more either federal spending or increase in HEX or HELP, whatever they call it now. So, yeah, I wouldn't mind crunching the numbers on that just to see what that looks like because that should be in the policy debate. That should be in the discussion we're having.
Yeah, well, I think it's the core of it. I mean, it's student visas that are pushing the whole migration issue. And it's student visas turning into permanent visas that is turning the total number of citizens, foreign citizens issue. So it's at the core of it. And yeah, if you double the size of university fees, some people would stop going. But I mean, you've also got the issue there that if people just go and then study, you know, lesbian dance theory or basket weaving, then they'll just go out, leave the country, not get a job. So they'll not pay that back, which still will leave those universities without enough money or the government having to pick up the bill. So at some stage, they'll have to incentivize people to start studying things that are only useful. And that fundamentally changes universities. Like a lot of universities there are going to have to shut down a lot of their useless departments that don't create people who add net value to the economy afterwards. I mean, they can continue on as hobbies, but now you're paying $100,000 a year for your hobby. I think a lot fewer people are going to take out that $100,000 a year hobby. They'll, you know, go and play soccer instead. Probably makes more sense.
Yeah, gee. Good points, John.
But that migration one is, if we go back to the original conversation here on the fertility, it's only one part of the puzzle, because it doesn't even fix the problem. Also, firstly, migrants who come in, because this was in the first intergenerational report back in 2001, I believe, when people said, oh, don't worry about the aging population, we've got migrants. The issue with that is migrants, this is the first comment I heard on this as the rejoinder was, migrants also get older, which is true.
Exactly.
Also, the migrants, once they come into this country, even if they come from a population that had a high fertility rate, and there's basically nowhere in the world that does anymore except the Congo and Zambia, as soon as they get to Australia, their fertility rate drops anyway. So the only way the migration answer works to solve the drop in fertility rate is if you continually bring in a higher percentage of migrants every year, which is just, it gets ridiculous, right? So you bring in, what is it, 1 million over the last 2 years, would have to bring in 1.5 million over the next 2 years, then 2 million over the next 2 years. It starts getting, and that's just raw numbers. You have to increase it as a percentage. So it's not a solution. It's not a solution to that problem. So we're going to have to go back and look for other solutions. The only real solution is to try to get the fertility rate up somehow. But if we don't even know what's causing it, then how do we work? What do you think's causing it, by the way, G? What's your theory?
It's got to do a lot with, the rise of, I think it is the breakdown in the, the social connections or the social relationships that we once had. I think you're right. I think you're right there. I mean, we've got a rise of singletons, haven't we, or people who live on their own or don't partner up and don't marry. I mean, I'm one of them, so I'm part of the problem, okay? We've basically got and that birth gap documentary.
It's not too late, Jane.
I know, it's definitely not. Too late. No, definitely not. The birth gap documentary highlighted it's not necessarily women who are in couples or marry or have partners who are the issue, because their fertility rate, I don't think, has changed much, has it? It's the fact that there's more and more women who never have children.
Oh, that's worth repeating, because this is something that I think a lot of people miss.
Yeah.
Just to give another history lesson, and I'm sorry, I love this issue. That's the wrong thing to say, because I think it's a deeply scary issue, but I find this issue fascinating. So I've done several deep dives, and you find that the fertility rate dropped off around the world in two different types. There's two different types of a drop-off. Firstly, when people went through the Industrial Revolution, and that happened in different areas at different times, average family sizes dropped from like 6 or 7 down to about 2.5 to 3. Or something like that. So that happened in different places at different times. Mm-hmm. And then you've had this second drop-off over the last 30, 40, 50 years, depending which country you're in, something around that. This is the modern history drop-off in fertility rates, where it's been, that's when it trended down to below 2. And the first one that happened in the Western world in the 19th century, that was just caused by people having smaller families, right? Your kids stopped dying in infancy. Yeah. So you ended up having fewer kids. That's very easy to understand. And then when people saw the second decline, where we went from 2.5 down to 1.5 and in lots of places down to 1.1 or 0.9 or lower, a lot of people just assumed, oh, this must be because people are still having smaller and smaller families. But that's not what happened in the second drop in fertility rates. So this second drop in fertility rates has not been caused by family sizes shrinking. And as you say, this the birth gap documentary, if you haven't watched it, just go to YouTube, Google birth gap. It's a fascinating and depressing insights in that. Good documentary.
Yeah.
As they pointed out, the average family size in a lot of these countries over the last 30, 40 years has stayed the same. If you have kids, the number of kids you have has stayed the same. Used to be, I think in America, used to be 2.5, still 2.5. What's happened is there's just this massive increase in childlessness. So we've got this childlessness epidemic, and a lot of that's being caused. And if you interview the people, because you say, oh, okay, people don't want kids, that's not what's changing. The actual rate of people who say they want kids has also stayed the same. What's happened is people who want kids, a increasing cohort of those people are putting off finding a partner and then trying to find a partner, and then they can't, and then they age out, and then they go, oh shit, I've missed it. And that's gone from, it used to be a couple of percent like that everyone felt very, sorry for. That cohort now has boomed, right? You now have a massive cohort. You walk around the cities, you can throw a rock and you'll hit 10 people like this. It's just childless people living a good inner city life. But that type of animal didn't used to exist, at least not in the numbers that we have it today. And that has boomed. And there's also a lot of regret that apparently there's coming from that, which is a very difficult sociological issue that we're going to have to learn to deal with.
Yeah, absolutely. I think in terms of what's caused it, I think your observations about the decline of those traditional connections, I think that has to be part of it. The rise of individualism and self-actualizations coming out of the 60s and into the 70s, the 80s. I think the whole culture's changed. I mean, the whole world's different now, and there's more of a focus on the career and how I can, you know, experience the world, travel and all of that. So, yeah, that's got to be part of it too.
Yeah, the other thing, and this is a very touchy issue for people to discuss on this one, but I mean, if we're just looking at the things that are correlated, it's pretty hard to avoid. There is a pretty stark correlation between the women's workforce participation. Which makes sense if you just think about the issue is a bunch of people want kids, but they're delaying it. Women now go to university more than men, and university now generally means more than, firstly, in Queensland, we start uni a year later than we did when I was a kid. And then 3 years is no longer enough. You have to do your 4-year undergrad plus your 2-year postgrad. So you're coming out in your early to mid 20s. And then if you've done 6 years of uni with your hex debt, you're not just going to finish that and refuse to get a job. I mean, at the end of your master's, you're looking for your grad job. You have to do your grad job for a couple of years before you can get into the career, you know, real career growth. And so before you know it, you've turned around and you're 30 and you haven't even started. Now, it used to be that most people had their kids before they were 25. And now people haven't even started thinking about kids until they're 30. Now, as the Birth Gap documentary shows, you turn around, you start when you're 30. If you're a woman, if you're a guy, your fertility window is a little bit longer. But if you're a woman, can they settle down? But if you spend a couple of years finding the right person and then spend a couple of years getting into the right situation, you can make it. But if you have like one relationship that takes up too much time and then doesn't work out, and not everyone finds the person they want to settle down with straight away. So yeah, that's and I'm not saying there's an easy solution there, but I mean that seems like it shows up in the data and it seems to make sense if you just think about the logic of spending 6 years at uni and 6 years in the workforce before you start looking to have a kid. It's going to mean that some people are unintentionally childless, which is exactly what we're seeing. The other one we see is inner cities. Inner cities are, big cities are fertility destroyers. So people who live regionally tend to have bigger blocks, and bigger houses on bigger blocks tend to be correlated with bigger families. And also people who live regionally tend to have closer ties with family, church, and community. So access to the all important backyard is one part of it. And that atomism as well, just the that there's this more atomistic individualism. But I think that kind of comes from some of the other things we've been talking about. But there's a lot in this. As you see, I get very animated when I talk about it and I lose total track of time. But this is not just an Australia-specific thing. I guess that's the important thing to take away from it. This is happening everywhere. So people try to look for an answer. When they first see the fertility rate drop in their own country, they think, oh, what's happened in my country lately? Well, you've got to explain what's happened in our country, in Korea, in Chile, in Bulgaria, in Ireland, and in Sri Lanka all at the same time. That makes it a bit harder to work out what's going on.
Yeah, but we had a period where it was where we were going against the rest of the world, and had increase in fertility in the in the early part of the century. Some people will say, well, that was the baby bonus. Do we need to bring something like the baby bonus back to promote fertility? I'm not sure to what extent it did cause it, but certainly we should be looking at what is it that is stopping people from wanting children. Why did we have that period where we were increasing infertility? Have we made our cities too difficult to live in? Have we is life just too costly now? Or do we need to try and promote those social ties? Although we don't really want government trying to do that, do we? What is it about government that is stopping those social ties from forming? Is it the welfare state? I suppose that would be the argument. That's the classic that'll be the classical liberal argument, wouldn't it?
Well, that was my argument at CPAC last year, right? I made the case that as the rise of the welfare state has crowded out the traditional role of family, church, and community. And everyone likes to think you join a family for love, you join a church for faith, you join a community for civic-mindedness. And that's probably the thing that's going on in the front of your cortex. But those institutions have been massively successful everywhere in the world, everywhere through history, for a reason. And I don't think it is just that everyone sort of had this same vibe of faith and love in the front of their cortex. It's because they were massively useful economic institutions that helped us coordinate in a very successful way. And if you take away some of those core economic reasons to form and be loyal to your family, church, and community, then people will start feeling like it's a little bit easier to flippantly, I don't really need that. And if I have one, it's a bit annoying, I can throw it away. And on all three of those counts, family, church, and community. And more flippantly throwing that away because instead you have another economic safety blanket. That used to be your economic safety blanket, your family, church, and community. But now instead you can just go get a check from the Centrelink office. Much less social interaction, much less human connection. But there is probably a more generous welfare check involved. And I would argue that creates less incentive to invest in family, church, and community. And the correlation there seems unstoppable. Everyone falls through tough patches from time to time and needs some sort of safety blanket. And that's what people, through this very atomized approach we have to the world now, people recognize that you can fall on hard times and you need a safety blanket. Yeah. And they look around and think, there is no safety blanket. It must be the government. We've always had one. History has always evolved some sort of system of a fallback mechanism. It has been through nearly all of history. Everywhere in the world, family, church, and community, or in some places, family, mosque, and community, or family, synagogue, and you get the idea, right? It's family, church, or equivalent, and community. And once we crowded it out, it got crowded out. And as an economist, I got to say that seems very predictable. So I would say the welfare state has something to do with it. But also, that's somewhat a convenient answer for me, I guess, as a libertarian and as an economist. I don't think that's the full answer, though, because I think there's another part of the answer which is much less convenient and I don't know what to do about, and that is the just decrease in transaction costs, right? And especially I'm talking transport and communication. The decrease in transport and when you have high transport and communication costs, it forces you to invest in your local community, in your family. You're stuck physically in one spot, and you are speaking to the people who are also stuck in the same spot with you. And that high transport and communication cost forces that investment in your local family, church, and community. And now when we've got low transaction costs, and I'm not saying we should have high transaction costs. I'm not saying let's chuck up all the barriers and blow up all the trains and destroy the internet. That's not a viable option, and I'm not suggesting that. And that's why this is a trickier part of the puzzle, because if the problem is the welfare state, you can wind back the welfare state. I can see a solution. If the problem is low transaction costs have just made it much more easy to be an atomized cog in the machine, you get a great job offer to go and live in Houston. 2 years later, you get a great job offer to go live in London. 3 years later, you get a great job offer to go live in Beijing. Great. There's nothing stopping you from doing that. You can just, the transaction costs are so low, you can just go hop, hop, hop. Great. Now you're 35 and don't have kids. Right. So it's, I say that with no solution in mind, but I think that's part of the issue. Just the low transaction costs has made it easier to hop between communities instead of investing in the community you've got.
Yeah, good point. Good point. Righto. Yeah. John, you think we touched any third rails tonight?
I think I did all the getting in trouble, so you're probably safe. But
we shall see. Righto, that's the end of this week's episode. Again, let me know what you think by emailing me at contact@economicsexplored.com and check out the show notes for relevant links. Thanks for listening, and until next week, goodbye.